Megan, I believed she had disclosed something real, something that would actually take place just as she'd shown it. It was a good feeling. With the wedding plans well in place, my gown carefully hung in my closet, and the cat fed, I was ready to move on with plans for another investigative report. That little cruise through North Salem the previous night had stirred something in my mind besides a desire for ice cream. I had nothing on my calendar that needed attention, so I decided to take another ride in that direction. Maybe I'd stumble onto some little clue, some tiny bit of information that could become inspiration. Once again, I backed the vet out onto Oliver Street, where the crow population had lessened considerably, and headed northwest toward Bridge Street. I had no predetermined destination in mind, and I almost surprised myself when I turned onto Dearborn Street. I passed the corner of Southwick Street and farther on slowed down as I approached the iron-gated Bagginstose mansion, until the driver in the car behind me gave an impatient blast of his horn. I finally pulled over beside the quite unlovely chain-link fence, separating vehicles and pedestrians from the sometimes up to the sidewalk at high tide, water of the North River. The tide wasn't high just then, so I climbed out of the car and, standing beside the chain-link fence, viewed a pleasant scene of placid water, a few small boats, and some greenery. I knew from the newspaper reports and from what I'd heard from Aunt Ibby that Gloria had died when she was thrown from her bike head first against one of the sturdy galvanized iron fence posts. Within seconds I was joined there by, wouldn't you know it, a crow. It perched at the top of the fence. This was a big one, and it had a red band on its right leg. I knew that the U.S. Department of Agriculture often banded birds, especially migratory ones. However, I'd become very much aware of black creatures wearing red anything. I looked at the bird's eyes. It cocked its head and opened its beak. I knew that crows could learn to speak. Poe was a good example of that. I'd seen one at a bird sanctuary in Florida who had a vocabulary of about 30 words. This crow looked at me and croaked one word perfectly clearly. Murder! I'm sure I answered out loud. What did you say? It looked at me again, spoke again. Murder! It said, and flew away. Chapter 40. I climbed back into my car and was about to start the engine when a green Toyota pulled in beside me. In what seemed like an instant, Sean Madigan appeared at my open window.
"Thought that was you,"
he said, leaning against my door, one arm propped against the convertible top of the vet.
"Hard to miss this little beauty. How come you're cruising past my place again? Looking for me?"
I felt an instantaneous flare of temper. This guy had a knack for bringing that out in me, and I didn't like the feeling. "No," I said, keeping my voice level. "And what do you mean, your place?" The smarmy smile.
"You know what I mean. My apartment over the garage at my friend Claudine's little ranch."
I checked my rearview mirror. This end of Dearborn Street isn't much traveled, and there were no vehicles, no pedestrians or bike riders in sight. "I don't like people touching my car," I said. "Back off or risk losing that arm." I tapped the gas pedal a couple of times, letting the big engine roar. He looked mildly surprised, but took a step back and raised both hands.
"Whoa," he said. "Don't get hostile. I just thought you might want to talk to me."
Now I was confused. What for? What would I want to talk to you about?
"About Claudine," he said. "About her collections. For that TV thing you're doing?"
His expression was all surprised innocence.
"Isn't that what this is all about? About her hiring me to appraise the collections for her?"
That was news to me. No, I said. "I have to go now."
"Listen," he said, leaning toward me again but being careful not to touch the car. "I'm sorry if I sounded rude the other day, but Claudine doesn't like people snooping around her backyard like you were doing."
"I wasn't snooping."
"Looked like it."
I shifted to reverse and started to back up slowly. "Goodbye," I said.
"See you at the rehearsal, then."
He waved, then folded his arms and watched as I drove away.
So, Sean Madigan was staying at the Bagenstos mansion to appraise the many collections Aunt Ibby had told me about. Maybe Sean had given me a good idea after all.
"Like a museum," my aunt had said about that house, and from what I'd seen, it was so.
What if Therese and her camera and I got a chance to show the WICH-TV audience some of those treasures?
I began to like the idea.
Pete had told me that the Bagenstow's house wasn't a good place for me to be, but work-wise it could turn out to be a perfect place. Thoughts of the report I could do on the contents of the great house had almost driven the memory of the talking crow out of my mind.
Almost?
Why had the thing said, "Murder!" at the place where Gloria had died? Had the hit-and-run been a deliberate attempt on the woman's life? I drove slowly along Dearborn Street, beneath the arching canopy of fine old trees. A few crows showed themselves, not a lot of them. I thought some more about that talking crow. Maybe my visions of crows and cats and Bridget Bishop made me imagine things that weren't real. A banded crow isn't an uncommon thing, even with a red band. Besides, that screechy, cackling voice could have said any number of things. Maybe it had just said mother, or birdie, or dirty. Probably it was just cawing and had spoken no words at all. Back to concentrating on report topics. I knew the Bagenstoses must have collected old paintings. I'd seen some of them. Why else would Claudine invite a shady character like Sean Madigan into her home? Or at least into her garage? Aunt Ibby had told me that Claudine had a big collection of late 19th and early 20th century fashions, too. The textbook on investigative reporting said that topics should be things people are curious about. Who in Salem could drive by that spooky old gated mansion and not wonder what's inside? I wondered, too. What else had they collected in there? Claudine had been gracious toward me, even remembering seeing me when I was a little girl. Maybe now that her husband was gone, she might be planning to sell some of their things. Maybe thinking about downsizing to a smaller place. She might even be glad of the extra publicity my report would give. I realized I was talking myself into ignoring Pete's advice to stay away from the place, but snooping is one thing, and serious research for one's job is quite another. As long as I was in the area, I could call on Aunt Ibby's friend, Bertha Barnes, to thank her in person for her excellent video of the crows stripping Gloria's tree. I could ask, politely, whether she had any more interesting pictures of crows. Or whatever. Did she save all of the pictures she took? I wondered. Impulsively, I took a quick left turn onto Southwick Street. I parked in front of the vacant Tasker house, making sure notebook and business cards were in my purse. I looked into Gloria's yard, curious about the state of the quince tree. The lawn looked a little shaggy, but the branches of the sturdy little tree had begun to sprout a bit of green, making me feel both pleased and relieved. If Pete was correct, Bertha's house should be the one on my right. Making sure my car was locked, just in case that story about bored teenagers was true, I squared my shoulders, marched right up to the nosy neighbor's front door, and rang the bell. A querulous voice from inside called,
"Just a minute. I'm coming."
The door opened a crack.
"Who are you, and what do you want?"
I held out my business card. "Hello there, Miss Barnes. I'm Lee Barrett, Ibby Russell's niece.
You helped me out on my very first appearance on the news. I was in the neighborhood and wanted to stop by to thank you personally. The door swung open immediately.
You're Mara Lee.
The plump little woman framed in the doorway looked like Central Casting's idea of everybody's grandmother. Bluish white hair in a tightly curled perm, granny glasses perched on a cute button nose, a floral print cotton dress, sensible shoes, the whole package. No wonder none of the neighbors turned her in for spying on them. She was completely adorable.
Come right in, dear.
She stood aside and ushered me into the house.
Ibby always speaks so fondly of you at the library book club meetings. She's very proud of you.
I followed her into a cozy living room. Chintz slipcovers on overstuffed chairs and love seat, maple-finished coffee table, and a matching hutch displaying a set of antique Camper plates, and accepted her offer of
a nice cup of tea and some cookies.
I could already smell the ginger snaps. I hadn't yet figured out how to ask politely if she'd happened to have her camera handy when Zeus caused a noisy commotion practically in front of her house. So, when she returned with the tea and cookies on a tin tray with a Courier and Ives reproduction on it, I just blurted it out. Mrs. Barnes, I imagine you must be part of the Neighborhood Watch program. So, may I ask a question about some strange things happening around here recently? I took a sip of tea. I only ask because of my new job. If it's none of my business, please say so.
Oh, sweetheart, she said. I'm glad you asked. You must be talking about the other night when that sweet dog from next door set up such a howl. I'm going to miss Zeus. I used to sneak him doggy biscuits under the fence. I hope that nice Jane didn't mind.
I'm sure she didn't. Go on. You were saying he made a lot of noise?
He did. I thought for a minute he'd been hit by that car.
What car?
It's a little green car. I'd seen it around here before. At first I thought it belonged to one of Gloria's gentleman friends who didn't know she'd passed. You know?
A green car. You didn't happen to have your camera with you that night, did you?
Of course I did, darling. It's always with me.
She reached into a pocket of her house dress and pulled out a small Minolta.
I even have pockets in my bathrobe, so if anything interesting happens at night, I can catch it on video. It's my hobby, you know.
Really? Do you, save all of your video records, Mrs. Barnes?
Oh, call me Bertha, hun. Everybody does. I don't save them all. No, indeed.
She glanced around the room as though she thought someone might be listening, and dropped her voice.
Most of them are pretty boring. This isn't a very exciting neighborhood since Gloria's gone. Now, what video did you want to know about?
If you took one on the night Zeus set up such a racket, I prompted, that's the one I'd like to see. Did you?
Sure did. Want to see it? It's kind of dark. I didn't want to use any lights, and it was late at night.
She stood and motioned for me to follow.
Come on into my hobby room.
It was a small room, and three walls had been fitted with floor-to-ceiling shelves. Rows of old-fashioned VHS videos with hand-lettered labels filled most of them. Hundreds of DVDs in plastic cases were stacked neatly in the others. You must have been collecting these for a long time. I tried to keep the absolute astonishment out of my voice. A really long time.
Not so long, hun. 10 years or so. It keeps my mind occupied, you know. Like they say, if you don't use it, you lose it.
She waved a hand at the packed shelves, and the two big-screen TVs on the fourth wall, with DVD and VHS players lined up beneath them. A wide recliner stood in the center of the room. A single straight chair stood beside it, a box of Whitman's chocolates on its seat.
Sometimes I watch two of them at a time. compare the old and the new. It's really fun.
She moved the chocolates to the arm of the recliner and motioned for me to take the vacated chair.
Here, sit.
Speechless, I sat.
I'll show you whatever you like, dear. I love keeping busy with my hobbies. Why, if it wasn't for my pictures and the library book club, I'd just be another boring old lady.
She pointed to a large wicker basket next to the recliner.
That and my knitting, of course.
The basket overflowed with skeins of colorful yarns. But what grabbed my attention most was the round Quaker oatmeal box beside the basket, jammed full of sharp-pointed knitting needles. Chapter 41. Naturally, the very idea that Bertha's knitting needles had anything to do with Zeus's injury or with Elliot Bagenstos's punctured eardrum was preposterous. But they did give me a chilling reminder that I wasn't just investigating barking dogs, nosy neighbors, however adorable, or tree-eating crows. I could be messing around with a murderer. I charged ahead anyway. Bertha, I'd like to see the one with the dog and the green car.
Sure, sweetheart. I'll put it up on the big screen for you.
She took a DVD from the shelf and loaded it into a Toshiba player.
Sorry it's so dark, but there was a street light, you know, so it's not too bad. Want to hear the sound, too?
She passed the chocolate box.
I like a little something to munch on while I watch my pictures. Have one?
I passed on the chocolate and said yes to the sound. It began with a dog barking, at first in the distance, then closer. Jane's U-Haul was in the center of the frame, just beneath a street lamp. Zeus came bounding into the picture, the barking turning into a growl as he disappeared behind the truck. A harshly whispered voice said,
"Get away from me!"
Zeus whimpered. Had the person kicked him? The whispering voice grew louder.
"Shit! Get away! God damn it!"
The dog howled as if in pain. There was the sound of footsteps running, and then the dog ran from behind the truck. A quick view of a Toyota, its color indistinct, flashed past as the camera panned away and focused on the yelping dog running toward Gloria's house. A faint voice, which I took to be Jane's, called the dog's name. The video ended.
"Well, was it what you expected to see, honey?"
Bertha asked.
"Not bad, seeing as how I shot the whole thing in the pitch dark, huh?"
"It looked good, Bertha," I told her. "And I'll tell you why I wanted to see it. Somebody injured Zeus that night, and it looks as though it happened right behind Jane's truck. Would you send me a copy of this? Abusing animals is wrong, and your pictures might help to find the person who hurt him."
"Okay, dear. I guess you're going to do a show about animals, huh? I like animals. I really liked Zeus. Is he going to be all right?"
I assured her that I'd spoken to Jane. She's going to have a vet give Zeus a thorough checkup as soon as they get home. I gave Bertha my email address, and she promised to send the video. I was sure Pete would be interested, especially that brief shot of a Toyota. I also knew he'd have something to say about my snooping, playing girl detective. But, as he'd pointed out, if I hadn't met Jane, found out about Bertha Barnes's hobby, and made friends with Zeus, he'd be missing a lot of good information. On my way back to Winter Street, I decided to take another little detour. I hadn't been inside Christopher Rich's shop since my Crystal Moon Nightshades days, when I'd sometimes bought props and Halloween decorations there. I knew that just as soon as he saw my WICH-TV business card, publicity-obsessed Christopher would welcome me like a long-lost sister. I was right about that. "Lee Barrett!" he exclaimed, pumping my hand and putting an arm around my shoulder at the same time. "What an honor to see Salem's newest TV star! Your report was fascinating, just fascinating. "Welcome to Christopher's Castle. What can I do for you today?" The shop had a pleasant sandalwood incense smell, and merchandise was attractively displayed. Unlike some of the many witch shops in the city, Christopher's Castle was far from gloomy or scary. Glass bowls filled with colorful crystals and polished gemstones shared space with witch-themed jewelry. Pentagram rings and necklaces, earrings shaped like dragons, silver bracelets like coiled serpents sparkled on velvet display pads. Costumes offered customers masquerade choices from fairies and elves to mummies and wizards. I extricated myself from his grip and pretended to be fascinated by a gold bust of Nefertiti. "It's been a long time since I've shopped here. I was at Town Hall when you gave your lovely tribute to Megan. I decided right then to drop in the next time I was in the neighborhood." I lied. "How are you doing, Christopher? I was shocked to hear about the gunshots. You must have been terrified." As I'd anticipated, the opportunity to talk about himself to a member of the media was too much to resist. He answered every question I threw at him and didn't object when I took notes. "I understand that the last two customers you had that night were Fabio the magician and a man we often see on TV protesting various things. An odd couple."
"They didn't come in together, you know."
He straightened a pile of Ouija board games.
"Fabio is a regular here. I have a huge inventory of magic supplies. He stops by nearly every morning on his way to work. He's a baker by trade."
"I know," I said, "a very good one. I've sampled some of his work lately. What about Victor Protector? Is he interested in magic, too?"
"A strange man. He's one of those oddballs who protests witches, yet he buys book after book about how to become one of us. I believe the police think he may have fired those shots at me."
"Do you think he did?"
"No, he didn't do it."
Rich sounded positive.
"And by the way, I didn't do it myself either, in case you've heard those nasty rumors. A jealous little witch named River is spreading that lie."
"Oops. I understand that Megan's Wiccan funeral will be held soon. My sources say Midsummer Night. True?"
He nodded. "You have good sources. Want to know another little secret? Off the record?"
"Of course I do." I put my pen down on the counter. "Off the record."
"Another person showed up on the outdoor surveillance camera on the building next door. Someone besides Fabio and Victor."
That surprised me. Pete must have known about this, but had never mentioned it. "Do you know who it was? Do the police know?"
"It was a woman. Hard to recognize her. She was hiding in the shadows, but the camera picked her out."
"Got a description?"
"Not a good one. Tall, wearing black. Call me crazy," he said. "I think I know who it is and why the cops can't find her."
"I won't call you crazy," I promised. "Who is she?"
"Bridget Bishop," he said. "You know who that is, don't you?"
"Of course," I stammered, brain reeling. "First witch hanged."
"Right," he said. "Psychics all over town are feeling her presence, smelling apples over at that restaurant. They're chalking it up to the anniversary of her death. I'm sure she was out in my parking lot that night. But what am I going to tell the cops? A ghost witch did it?"
I hadn't heard that about the psychics. I wondered if River had. I said the first thing that popped into my head. "Can a ghost shoot a gun?" He shrugged and half smiled.
"Not very well, I guess, since she missed me by a mile."
"Why would Bridget Bishop be mad at you?" He looked around the shop. We were alone, but he whispered anyway.
"I put a spell on a fellow witch. A bad spell. Killed him."
I wanted to tell him what I'd told River, that bad thoughts and witch spells don't really kill people. But I remained silent. "Let him talk."
"We vowed to do no harm, you know, but I used one of Bridget Bishop's own spells."
Impossible. River has the spellbook.
It was the only one of her spells I'd ever seen. Aerial Constellation sold it to me a long time ago. I paid a lot of money for it. Aerial told me I should never use it in anger, but I did, and a man died.
Elliot Bagginstose?
Did you destroy the paper the spell was written on, so it will never fall into the wrong hands? I asked, keeping my voice level, professional.
That would seem to be the right thing to do. I thought about selling it at first. Couldn't do it. So I burned it to ashes. Not a scrap of it left.
If it burned, it wasn't Bridget Bishop's spell.
Christopher Rich, you were snookered by Aerial Constellation.
I couldn't tell him that, of course. But when the police figured out who'd really killed Elliot, Christopher could stop blaming himself.
So could River.
Anyway, the woman in the parking lot could very well have been Bridget. She wasn't shy about appearing to me any darn time she felt like it, and I'm not even a witch.
But I doubted seriously that a camera could have captured her image, even if she was there.
I understand why you might think you saw Bridget, I said. But you must admit, a woman in a black dress is a fairly ordinary sight.
You're right, of course, Lee. I should never have mentioned it. Well, I'm sure you have better things to do than listen to an old man ramble.
He reached for a colorful brochure on the countertop and handed it to me.
By the way, I'm sure you know that I'm a bit of an expert on things magical. I'd be more than happy to be a guest on your program.
Oh, I'll just bet you would.
Thank you, Christopher.
Realizing that I'd just been dismissed from Christopher's castle, I put the brochure into my handbag.
I'll certainly keep you in mind.
I was halfway back to my car when I realized I hadn't asked Christopher why he was angry enough with a fellow witch to use such a powerful spell, or at least what he believed was one. And I was darn sure he wasn't about to tell me who he'd cast it on.
Chapter 42
Pete's Pee Wee hockey team had a night game at the Rockette Arena over near the college, so I didn't expect to hear from him until late. He always takes the team out for pizza after the game, win or lose. I sat at my kitchen table and pulled out the notebook, realizing I had a lot to learn from Pete about note-taking. Orion watched from the windowsill as I ripped out the day's sketchy, messy entries and attempted to make some sense of this very strange day. My maid-of-honor dress was safely stashed in my closet, and Megan had shown me the way to return Bridget Bishop's book, so I didn't need to record those two items. I started a fresh page.
Talking Crow? Maybe.
Madigan lives over Claudine's garage, appraises antiques. Bertha Barnes? Adorable. DVDs and VHSs of Neighbors. Video of Zeus. She knits. See Rich angry with River, said he fired shots. Saw tall person in black behind shop.
B. Bishop?
See Rich used B.B. curse on man who died.
Elliot?
Note, C.R. says Victor P. reads about joining witches.
Weird.
Okay, it looked neater, but did it make any more sense? I closed the book and faced the cat. Sean Madigan must think I'm stalking him, I said. Or is he stalking me? Orion ignored my question and kept the golden eyes focused on the outdoors. I kept talking to him anyway. Sometimes I think it helps to hear my thoughts out loud.
Mrs. Barnes is a doll. You'd like her.
I saw a video about a good dog named Zeus. River thinks Christopher Rich shot those bullets himself.
I don't know what to think.
Oh, yeah, I might have heard a crow say murder. He turned and looked at me when I said the word, and gave a slow, solemn couple of nods of the big fuzzy head. So the crow and the cat think Gloria's accident was not an accident. How can that be? Could someone have followed Gloria in the early morning darkness, deliberately forced her into the fence? It could have happened that way.
Gloria and Elliot Bagginstose, both witches, had died a few weeks apart. Gloria had been first. Had anyone checked Gloria's eardrums? I hoped Pete would call after the hockey game. I had a lot to tell, and even more to ask. It was nearly 10 o'clock when that welcome phone call came. I must have sounded like a babbling goof as I tried to explain the day's happenings all at once. In his most professional, quiet cop voice, he said,
"Take it easy, babe. Relax. I'll be there in half an hour. Gotta drop the nephews off. Calm down, okay?"
The advice didn't help much. By the time Orion ran to the living room door and the bell chimed, "Bless this house," I was in full fidgety mode. Couldn't sit still or think straight. I pulled the door open. "I'm so glad you're here," I told him. "I need to talk to you."
"I got that," he said, pulling me close. "What the hell is going on? You're nervous as a bitsy bug."
I've always meant to ask Pete exactly what a bitsy bug is, but that could wait for another time. We sat on the couch together, and I told him in rapid succession about the crow, the nosy neighbor, Sean Madigan, Chris Rich, and the woman in black. He nodded, said all the right things, made me feel a lot better. It was when I got to the question about Gloria's injury that he sat up straight, frowned, and said,
"Jesus, Lee, I don't know. She was a mess. Hit and run, blunt trauma to the head with no helmet. I saw the Emmy's photos. I'm sure her eardrums were smashed, along with most everything else in her head. Jesus, never thought about it. You may be onto something there."
We wound up drinking decaf in the kitchen, as usual. I told him in more detail about how Sean Madigan had followed me to the end of Dearborn Street, startled me, even leaned on my car. That last one still ticked me off. "He acts as though I'm stalking him," I complained. "Fat chance of that ever happening." Pete's smile was wry.
"Yeah, I heard about that."
It was my turn to frown. "What do you mean? Heard about it from where?"
"From Madigan. He thinks you're stalking him."
I put my mug down so hard, coffee splashed onto the tabletop. "What?" He leaned forward, both elbows on the table.
"It's police business," he said. "But it looks as though I'm going to have to let you in on it before you get yourself hurt."
"I don't get it." And I surely didn't. "You mean the art thief is involved in police business somehow? With you?"
"Okay. Here's how it all went down. A few months ago, Madigan contacted us from the minimum security prison where he was doing his time. He said he had some information about stolen paintings we might want to know about. Wanted to make a deal."
"What did you say?"
"He didn't talk to me. Art crimes is above my pay grade. But it seems that after Elliot Bagginstose died, his widow got a message through to Madigan that she had about 50 pieces of major artwork to sell. Wanted to know if he could appraise them, then get rid of them for her in exchange for a piece of the action."
"What made him think they were stolen?"
"She mentioned some titles and artists. He recognized some of them as stolen,"
Pete said.
"The guy knows his business."
"Wow. Did he agree to do it?"
"No. He told us about it right away. Said he might be able to help us find some valuable paintings that have been missing for a long time."
"Is that how come he got out of jail early?"
"Exactly. He got his sentence shortened in exchange for finding whatever stolen paintings are in the Bagginstose's house."
Pete leaned back in his chair.
"Surprised?"
"Surprised that he's on your side of the law," I said. "But I still don't like him."
"That's fine. You don't have to like him. Just stay out of the way and let him get on with what he's doing."
"No problem with that," I said. "Has he found any paintings yet?"
"I think I've told you all you need to know for now. Thanks for the tip about Gloria's ear. I'll talk to you tomorrow."
He stood. "Oh, yeah. Mrs. Barnes is sending over the video of Zeus barking at whoever was messing with Jane's truck. You can't see much, though. The action was behind the U-Haul. All you see is poor Zeus running with his tail down and a blur of a Toyota, and somebody cussing in the background. Pete sat down again.
A Toyota?
Yep. Surprised?
It fits right in with something Madigan told us. Son of a gun.
He stood up, smiling.
Thanks again, Lee. Good job.
You're welcome. Can you tell me what I did?
Sorry. Not yet.
He looked at the Kit Kat clock and stood again.
Can't stay tonight, babe. Early meeting in Boston with some bigwigs. I'll call when I get back. When you get that video, will you forward it?
I said that I would, and after a few nice kisses and a promise to call me, he went out the living room door and down the stairs, leaving me with even more questions than I'd had in the first place. So, Sean Madigan was working with the police to solve some art thefts, and Claudine Bagenstos might be in it, right up to her Van Cleef and Arpels earrings. Chapter 43. I added the bombshell about Sean Madigan to my notes. I found it hard to believe. The notorious art thief working undercover for the police? That's the stuff that TV shows are made of. You can't tell a crook by his cover, I wrote, then sat back and smiled at my own little joke. The video from Bertha arrived just then, and I dutifully forwarded it to Pete. There was a new text message from Jane, too. She was making good time and expected to be home by the next day. Zeus seemed fine. She planned on taking Pete's advice about contacting an appraiser to check out the things she'd inherited from Gloria. That seemed wise to me. Besides, it might possibly tell us what the person behind the truck in Bertha's video had been looking for.
Hope Zeus didn't catch anything from whoever he bit, she texted.
I'd almost forgotten about that dog bite, but I was sure Pete hadn't. Orion had abandoned his windowsill by then and joined me at the table. He concentrated on washing his face for a minute, then, with a big, pink-tongued yawn, jumped down from his chair and trotted to the bedroom. I yawned, too, and followed him. Sleep was an excellent idea. The next few days moved quickly. Hilda and Maureen and I gave a bridal shower for Shannon at the Salem Waterfront Hotel on Pickering Wharf. Pretty party catered. And guess who was part of the entertainment? The fabulous Fabio, doing some wedding-themed magic tricks. He made a giant fake diamond ring appear on a guest's finger, then pulled a stuffed bunny dressed like a bridegroom out of his tall white chef's hat. His performance was surprisingly good, and when I had a chance to speak with him for a few minutes between the cake cutting and the bridal bingo game, I told him so. I also worked in a couple of questions about what he'd seen and heard after leaving the magic shop on the night somebody shot at Christopher Rich. "Did you hear the shots?" I asked.
"Sure did."
He put a plate full of pink iced cupcakes on a nearby table.
"Try one of these. There's a plastic engagement ring in one of them. Whoever gets it will be the next one to get married."
"What if she's already married?"
"Don't know. It's never happened."
He smiled and raised both hands in the air.
"Anyway, like I told the cops, I was right at the edge of the parking lot. Then, boom, boom, shots came from somewhere in the bushes behind me."
"You must have been scared to death. What did you do?" He smiled.
"I'm ex-military, so I hit the deck at the first one."
"So you never saw the shooter?" I'd hoped he'd say something about a shadowy figure in black, but he stuck to his story.
"Didn't see a thing. It was dark, and I had my head down."
"Did you hear anybody running away?"
"Not exactly."
"What do you mean, not exactly? You heard something, then?"
"Birds. I heard birds making a commotion, so I knew something had disturbed them. They don't usually squawk late at night."
He snapped his fingers, and a paper rose appeared in his hand.
"Sorry. Have to go make balloon animals. Nice talking to you."
He handed me the flower, then moved away. I knew without asking that the noisy birds were crows. I stuck the rose in my hair, reached for one of the pink cupcakes, then changed my mind. What if I got the ring? I wasn't ready for another marriage just yet. Why tempt fate? The shower was fun and a big success. Shannon looked so happy, so beautiful, absolutely glowing. She'd brought Poe along with her, thinking that it might help him become accustomed to being around a crowd, and it seemed to work. She'd handed his tether to Maureen while she unwrapped gifts, and he didn't seem to mind being passed from hand to hand. He did, however, single me out with a,
"Hey, Red, who loves your baby?"
He seemed to know me. Shannon said he watches a lot of television and might have seen me on Nightshades. Maybe she was right. I said, "Hi, Poe. Nice to see you again." No point in being rude. After all, Poe wasn't the only member of the crow community who'd spoken to me recently. The shower was just one of many wedding-related events leading to that special day. Hilda and Maureen, along with some of Shannon's other young friends from school, hired a limo and took Shannon to Boston for a bachelorette party. I bowed out of that celebration, pleading age and teacher status, leaving me a welcome evening free from making table centerpieces with net and glitter, constructing beach-themed place cards, and putting custom-printed Shannon and Dakota labels on champagne bottles. Naturally, I spent it with Pete. We held hands across a table at Green's Tavern. "Pete, if I ever again agree to be somebody's maid of honor," I said, "please talk me out of it."
"I'll try, babe," he said. "But in just a few more days, the bride and groom will walk down the aisle and say, 'I do.' Then you'll say how beautiful it all is and be ready to do it again."
I sighed and took a sip of light beer. "I know you're right, but just now I don't care if I never even get invited to another one. Ugh, let's talk about something else."
"How about this?"
He pulled the ever-present notebook from his jacket pocket and flipped through the pages. I remembered that mine was at home on my desk.
"Here it is. I heard from our friend Jane this morning. She thanked me for suggesting that she get an appraiser for Gloria's things. Turns out the jewelry was worth much more than she'd thought, but the big surprise was one of the paintings."
"I thought all along it would be a painting since Madigan was interested in them," I said. "What was it? Something famous?"
"Not so much famous as stolen."
His expression was serious.
"It was a small oil painting of Judith Sargent Murray by John Singer Sargent. It was stolen from a private collection back in the 60s.
He closed the notebook. "Wow. What will become of it now?"
"Jane returned it to the family it was stolen from. There's a reward from the insurance company involved, but mostly she wanted to do the right thing. What we want to know is how a waitress in Salem wound up with it."
Our pizza arrived, half pepperoni and half extra cheese. I helped myself to a big slice from the cheese half. "Is Sean Madigan helping with that?" I asked, knowing I was pushing my luck in the
"that's police business"
department, but feeling as though I deserved an answer. "I got one."
"He is."
Period. End of answer. I tried another angle. I talked to Fabio, the magician, about the night when he witnessed the shooting behind the magic shop. He says the shots came from the bushes behind him. That means Rich didn't fire them himself, doesn't it?
"Seems to. We never thought he'd done it in the first place. He was too freaked out about it after it happened."
He reached for a second slice of pizza.
"Hard to fake that much fear."
He believed in the idea that someone was loose in Salem killing witches. I think he still does. Pete's cop voice kicked in.
"He may be right about that after all."
That surprised me. I was quiet for a moment. "Did you talk to Victor Protector about it? Chris Rich says he goes around protesting everything, but he buys books about learning to be a witch. Strange, huh?"
"We've talked to him. He gets paid for leading the various protests. Claims he doesn't personally believe in most of them.
He shook his head.
Strange damned way to make a living, but he certainly has the right to free speech.
Had he heard anything about who might be targeting witches? After all, he hangs around with those people.
Sorry, he said. Confidential information there.
I sighed. I understand. But the police department rules sure get in the way of some interesting conversations. We switched to a safer topic. Crows. We talked about the lessening numbers of them, halfway regretting that the city might not have to use the pyrotechnic system to chase them away. We both love fireworks. Although during the recent hectic days of wedding preparation, Pete and I had talked on the phone every day and had lunch together a couple of times, I hadn't brought up again the matter of the talking crow, who may or may not have said murder. And I knew better than to ask him about the condition of Gloria Tasker's eardrums, let alone Elliot Bagginstose's. Knitting needles were not mentioned either. But that hadn't stopped me from thinking about them. Chapter 44. It seemed as though it had been a long time since Pete had spent the night at my apartment. From the way Orion carried on, purring and rolling over and meowing loving cat words, you'd have thought it had been months instead of a week. It felt that way to me, too. Conversation about crows and stolen art and shooting stopped at the door. I didn't even bother to look at my email or check the table in the downstairs front hall, where Aunt Ibby always put whatever the letter carrier had left for me. In the morning we had time for a leisurely breakfast, so I was able to use up some of my surplus groceries. I fixed bacon and eggs and English muffins served with coffee and Aunt Ibby's homemade marmalade. It was a wonderful start to the day. Pete kissed me goodbye at 9 o'clock with a promise to call later. The wedding rehearsal dinner was scheduled for 7 o'clock that evening. Wanda the weather girl promised no rain, warm breezes, and a late sunset. Summer had arrived in Salem. I'd scheduled a pedicure, shampoo, and blow-dry for 3:30, but my time was my own until then. It felt good. I'd finished making the bed, straightening up the kitchen and putting the dishes away when there was a tap at the kitchen door. "Yoo-hoo, Marilee, it's me," my aunt called in a soft voice. I smiled and opened the door. Who else would it be? "Good morning. Come in," I said. Orion was first through the door, my aunt following. She handed me a stack of mail, bills, catalogs, letters, advertising flyers, a magazine or two. "These have begun to pile up in the past few days. I know you've been busy with the wedding and all, but I thought there might be something important here." I tossed the pile onto the table and gave my aunt a hug. "I doubt it, but thanks so much for looking after me. You always have. Got time to sit down and visit for a while?" "Of course I do." She pulled out a lucite chair, picked up the cat, and sat with Orion on her lap. I pushed the coffee maker's on button, then took the chair opposite hers. "We need to catch up on things," I told her. "Shannon's wedding has been a lot more time-consuming than mine and Johnny's was." It was true. Johnny and I had been married in a tiny chapel just outside of Orlando. Johnny was a rising star on the NASCAR circuit, and we'd wanted to avoid the army of sports reporters who followed him around. Our attendants had been a girl who worked with me on the home shopping show and one of Johnny's fellow drivers. Johnny's mom and Aunt Ibby and a few of our closest friends comprised the guest list. I wore white and carried orange blossoms. It was perfect. "I have a bit of an ulterior motive in bringing your mail up here," she admitted. "I've been consumed with curiosity about one of your letters ever since it arrived a couple of days ago." She pulled a cream-colored oblong envelope from the pile and handed it to me. "This one." I accepted the hand-addressed envelope and recognized the return address immediately. "Claudine Bagginstose?" I gasped. "Why is she writing to me?" "That's what I'm dying to know, too. my aunt said. Unless it's none of my business, of course. She leaned forward. Aren't you going to open it?
Oh, yes.
I unsealed the envelope flap and pulled out a creamy folded sheet bearing the monogram CB in raised black letters. After unfolding it, I read the short message aloud. My dear Lee, it says, I've thought about your suggestion that some of the lovely antiques Elliot and I acquired during our many happy years together might be of interest to your viewers. I'll be at home between 2 and 3 on the afternoon of the 20th. If you care to drop by, you can see if you think it's a good idea. No camera yet, of course. Hope to see you then. If this is inconvenient, we'll do it another time. Cordially, Claudine Bagenstos. A telephone number followed.
My goodness!
Aunt Ibby's eyes were wide.
That's today. What are you going to do?
Conflicting thoughts flashed through my overstuffed brain, one after the other. If I went, would it look as though I were stalking Sean Madigan? If I didn't go, would I miss the opportunity to give viewers a peek inside the gates of a museum-like home most Salem people would never see any other way? If I went, would Pete think I was snooping? If I didn't go, would I be behaving unprofessionally? If Claudine was actually involved somehow with stolen art, why would she invite TV cameras into her home? The obvious answer to that one was that she probably wouldn't.
I heard that she was thinking of moving to a smaller place now that Elliot's gone.
Aunt Ibby interrupted my barrage of contradictory thoughts.
Must cost a fortune to heat and cool that old mausoleum. Claudine's smart. I'll bet she is planning to use your TV footage to advertise the house and the antiques to prospective buyers.
Mr. Doan would probably like the idea, I said, and I'm sure there's an audience for it.
Aunt Ibby agreed. Kind of a cross between Antiques Roadshow and Lifestyles of the Rich and Famous. I know I'd watch it, even if I didn't know you.
Pete asked me not to go snooping around there, and Sean Madigan thinks I'm stalking him. My aunt gave a ladylike sniff.
Stalking him! Outrageous nonsense! And pursuing your career isn't snooping by any means. Besides, you've been invited.
True. I think I should do it. Let's see. If I stick to Claudine's schedule and leave there at 3, I'll still have plenty of time to get my hair and nails done. My mind raced. So much for the leisurely day I'd planned. If I can focus on the right collections, like furniture and clothes, I said, I'll promote it as an investigation into Salem's fashionable past, a time capsule of Salem history spanning decades, all in one historic home. Aunt Ibby clapped her hands, startling the cat.
I love it, she said. I can help with the research. Just take good notes. Try to get accurate dates. I can help you put together a proposal for Bruce Doan the minute this wedding is over.
The more I thought about it, the better I liked it. If the visions Megan had shown me were correct, she'd be returned to the earth and be able to go on to a beautiful place the witches call Summerland. Bridget Bishop would have her book back from River, and the crows would be gone from Salem. There'd be no point in doing a follow-up on crows. It would be old news, and besides, without fireworks, it wouldn't be much fun. I think I'll call her and tell her I'll be there at 2, I said. And I'll call Pete, too, and let him know what I'm doing. Then he can tell Sean Madigan that if he sees my car, he doesn't need to worry about me stalking him. What a jerk. I think it's a good opportunity for another successful report for you. I'd love to go with you. What a treasure trove you'll see.
She shooed Orion from her lap and stood.
I can't wait to get started. I know Claudine's great-grandmother was a suffragette. I'll bet the old newspaper archives at the library reported on her, probably in a not-too-flattering way. Those brave women put up with a lot. Don't get up. I'll let myself out.
She and the cat were out the door in seconds, and she hadn't even had her coffee.
I did as I'd said I would. I called Claudine and confirmed the appointment for 2 o'clock. I called Pete, too, but it went right to voicemail. I left a message. He'll probably worry about me, but what can happen at 2 in the afternoon on a sunny spring day in North Salem? By 1:45, I was headed across the overpass to North Street. At 1:57, I was admitted through the gate at the Baginstow's house. I parked in the long driveway, far enough from the garage doors so that if anyone wanted to back out, the vet wouldn't be in the way. Making sure that I had notebook, pen, and business cards, I walked to the front door and rang the bell. A uniformed maid answered the door, giving me a questioning look. I handed her a card. Lee Barrett from WICH-TV. Mrs. Baginstow is expecting me. She nodded, placed my card on the same silver tray where Claudine had put the last one, and motioned for me to follow. She ushered me into a different room this time, more of a den, with surprisingly contemporary furnishings. Claudine sat in a maroon recliner with her feet elevated on the footrest. No black flapper dress this time. She wore bright Gucci print palazzo pants with a white eyelet blouse and looked absolutely stunning. She spread her hands in welcome but didn't stand.
Lee, dear, thank you for coming. I'm just a bit wobbly on my feet today. A bit of arthritis in my knee has been kicking up lately.
She reached for a sheaf of papers on the mahogany drum table beside her.
These are notes about the collections we use for our occasional house tours. I'd like to show you around myself, but I've asked my associate, Mr. Madigan, to escort you through the house.
A silvery giggle.
It's easy to get lost in here if you don't know your way around, isn't it, Sean?
Yes, ma'am, came the now familiar voice from behind me.
Sean, this is Lee Barrett. Ms. Barrett is a reporter from WICH-TV. Lee, Mr. Madigan is an expert antique appraiser, so I'm sure he can answer any questions you might have.
Mr. Madigan and I have met, I said, trying hard to keep the frostiness out of my voice. We have some mutual friends. He nodded, oh so politely, and accepted the tour script from Claudine's perfectly manicured fingers.
Ms. Barrett, shall we begin? I understand you've allotted just an hour.
If you decide to do this, Lee, Claudine promised, you and I will spend plenty of time prowling through this old wreck of a place together. Won't that be fun?
I'm sure it will. Thank you for the opportunity. I hope your knee feels better soon.
Oh, arthritis comes and goes. Just part of the aging process, I guess. Go along now. Sean, be sure to show Lee my great-grandmother's suite.
I followed the silent appraiser from the room, wondering whether having him serve as my guide had really been Claudine's idea, or whether Pete had told him I was coming and to keep an eye on me. I didn't have to wait long for an answer. We climbed up a curving staircase, longer and wider than the one on Winter Street. Once out of earshot of Claudine, he whispered,
I told you this isn't a good place for you to be. What do you think you're doing?
My job, same as you, I told him. Are you going to show me Great-Grandma's room or not? We only have an hour.
It's right down this corridor. Pete called and told me that you'd be snooping around, and that I should be sure you're okay. Had to talk the old lady into letting me play guide dog.
He opened a door at the end of a red-carpeted corridor.
Here's the great-grandmother's room. She was a suffragette.
He consulted the paper.
She traveled to California and Washington, D.C. with Inez Milholland.
I already knew that, and how the press paid more attention to Milholland's beauty than to her message. The room was wonderful. The wealthy Victorian lady's bedroom, from the curvy quilted headboard on the rosewood bed, right down to the French ivory comb, brush, and hand mirror on the matching dressing table. I made some notes under my escort's watchful eye, then pulled my smartphone from my handbag. Mind if I snap a few pictures? They'd be for my own use, not for broadcast.
All right with me, He said, none of my business.
He pulled open a closet door.
I guess you want to see her clothes, right?
Yes, please, I said. It was a very modern, light